First, we'll look at why you want to use JavaScript and what things you can do with JavaScript. We're looking at some advanced features of the language. Look at some patterns and techniques that are pretty useful when programming with JavaScript. And finally, we'll also see how we can debug JavaScript and how we can analyze our code to find possible errors and so on. Why JavaScript? JavaScript is a pretty lightweight language compared to some other languages. JavaScript doesn't have a static type system. That may be an advantage. It may also be a disadvantage. The most important reason why you want to use JavaScript is that functions are first-class objects. But the ultimate reason is because you have to. You have to use JavaScript because that's pretty much the only language that's available in the browser. And if you want to script things in the browser, you ultimately have to use JavaScript. There's also some confusion regarding to DOM, the document object model. The document object model is basically just an API for accessing elements on a web page. The DOM is not at all JavaScript specific. You can also use the DOM with other languages such as PHP, Java, and so on. So DOM is not JavaScript, and JavaScript is not the DOM. The DOM has a pretty bad reputation, though, because there are some incompatibilities between browsers. It has a pretty verbose syntax. For example, you have to use functions or methods like getElementByTagName, and they're pretty tedious to write. And because the DOM is rather inconvenient to use, you have to write a lot of code to do simple things. Next, JavaScript versus browsers. JavaScript originated in Netscape, in the Netscape Navigator, as LiveScript. But JavaScript is not at all specific to browsers. You can use JavaScript in many other different environments, such as scripting, user interfaces. For example, all the Mozilla apps are scripted using JavaScript. That means you can modify the user interface or the user interface's actions with JavaScript. You can also script Adobe applications with JavaScript. JavaScript was used as a base language for ActionScript, which is in the Flash Player by Adobe. You can also use JavaScript on the server side to run server-side applications. And that's what I'm going to show you. Okay. There's a website, AppChat, that allows you to write server-side applications in JavaScript. And that's a sample application I wrote in like an hour. What it does is it pulls in the Twitter feed from users and displays them, for example, like that. Or I can just enter another name, and it automatically pulls in the Twitter feed and displays it. And that's something you can do on the server side. You can also, of course, create much more complicated things. There's even an application, a web application framework written in JavaScript that runs on the server that allows you to create, or that is basically a content management system. Okay. You can also do other things. For example, you can do 3D rendering in the browser. That's not that good performance-wise, but it is possible. You can also read ID3 tags from MP3 files, for example, by just loading the file in the browser and then looking at the binary file and extracting the ID3 tags from it. And you can even implement other programming languages in JavaScript. That's what John Resick has done with the processing language The processing language is a language to visualize things. These are things you can do with the processing language, and John Resnick has written a parser for that language that shows these things written in that language here in their browser. Okay, next up, advanced language features. In JavaScript, functions are first-class entities. Some might not call functions as advanced, but actually they are in JavaScript because you can store functions in variables, you can pass functions as parameters, you can return functions from functions. You can pretty much define functions at any place you have. Functions can contain properties, so you can also add a function to a function. You can create anonymous functions. And JavaScript, of course, supports closures. What that is, we get to that later. A little example. We define a function. The function has one parameter called callback. That parameter has to be a function, and we can just call that function or that parameter function. Then we can return a function from that function. We execute that function and execute the return function right away by putting the parentheses after the first parenthesis. And we pass a function to that function. And that's something you can do in JavaScript. You can also add a property to that function, of course, and next is object orientation in JavaScript. JavaScript does not have a classical object orientation with classes. JavaScript doesn't have classes at all. JavaScript has the concept of prototypal object orientation. That means you can have a function that is a prototype. That function acts as the constructor for the class, and the function, the constructor function, can have a prototype property, which contains further methods. And when you instantiate a new class with a new operator, you get a new class from that, based on that old class. Let's look at how this looks in JavaScript. We just define a function. This is the constructor function. We add a prototype to that, and we add two methods, bar and bass, here. And we can create a new instance by just writing new foo, and then we can execute the methods of that object. Like I said, a function is a constructor, and the instances created from another object are or have implicit links to the base class. What that means is we just define a function here and a prototype with another method. We create a new instance, and we can execute the bar function. We add a new method to the prototype, so the base class, and the instance that we created before automatically gets the new method. JavaScript is very flexible, and you can also extend or add attributes at any time. You can even change the language itself. For example, you can add a method to the number object. Number objects are pretty much all the integers and other numbers used in JavaScript. We have this Celsius to Fahrenheit function here, which converts the number to Fahrenheit, from Celsius to Fahrenheit, using this formula. And on the JavaScript console, we just can execute 34 Celsius to Fahrenheit, and we'll get the result back. The same is possible with strings, objects, functions, arrays, and so on. And null Celsius are 32 Fahrenheits. Next, scope. JavaScript has a lexical scope that's also known as static scope. A scope means basically that, the scope contains basically everything that is visible when the function is defined in JavaScript. So, we'll get to examples later to illustrate that. And in that function, this is the context the function is executed in. That means you can execute a function in different contexts, and based on what context you execute that function in, this is a element from the document or basically something else, and you can just manipulate this and execute it in different functions, in different environments. Now let's look at an example. We just have a function here and a variable foo. And from that function, we return another function which logs or prints that variable foo. And we execute that outer function right away. So bar actually contains the inner function, which just prints foo. However, if the inner function is stored in bar, it can still access the variable foo from the outer function, or that is defined within the outer function, even though it is not really visible elsewhere. So you can't manipulate foo afterwards, after the variable bar contains the return function. And we can just execute bar now, because bar is a function, and we get foo back. And there's no way to change foo anymore. So the scope of the outer function lives until everything is, or until something in it can still be executed. Since the inner function can still be executed because it is stored in bar, the scope is preserved, and the variables are still present. Okay. The scope is on after the outer function returned, even after. Let's look at a more complex example. This is just another table of conversion options. Just remember this a second, because I don't have space on the other slide. We have the function which we execute right away. Note the parenthesis after the bracket. Formulas in that function is the object I've shown you before. We now loop over each item in these formulas like that. So, and then we define a new number prototype for numbers, and we just concatenate the from the two to create a new function name. So the names are Celsius to Fahrenheit, Celsius to Réaumur, and so on. And that number prototype is a function that is executed right away, like that. And as parameters, it gets the formula from that particular from that particular conversion. In that function that is executed right away, we return a new function that evaluates the formula, and we have to do that because when the loop continues and we don't create a new scope with that outer function here. From and to are different things, so they basically continue until the end of the object. And to preserve the state at that particular point, we have to create a new scope. And that's what we do here. We just pass the formula into that inner function, and the very inner function here can then evaluate the formula, even though it is executed after the fact. Number prototype. Okay, we've now loaded that function. It's not a function. Okay, that's a different file then. Let me check. And number Fahrenheit to Celsius is that function that just evaluates the formula. And the formula is implicitly available in that function because it was in the outer function. Can just execute 90 Fahrenheit to Celsius. And it will return the temperature in Celsius.
Can you make only the visible?
Pardon? I could by just printing it in that inner function. Just change that here. Okay. When we look at number dot prototype dot Fahrenheit to Celsius. I now added the print formula and 90. It now prints the formula first and then executes the formula using eval. Using eval is not that good, but I just use it for that example because it was easier. Okay. JavaScript also allows you to use functional style programming for looping through arrays or applying functions to arrays and so on. There's, for example, the for each function that allows you to execute a function for each element of an array. There are also many other functions like map or reduce and so on. JavaScript 1.7 is available since Firefox 2. However, as far as I know, most other browser windows don't really support JavaScript 1.7. And even in Firefox 2, you have to specifically enable JavaScript 1.7 by using a special language name in the script tag, One example that is, or one feature that is available in JavaScript 1.7 are generics or iterators. For example, we have this Fibonacci function that pretty much loops forever, while true, loops forever, and there's no break whatsoever. But there's a yield statement inside that function. And that means as soon as the first yield statement is reached, it returns that returns that value, and the function or the code that called that Fibonacci function can do whatever it wants with that value, and then it can also request the next value. And so the function execution is resumed at the yield statement, and the while loop continues until the next yield statement. This can be used, for example, like that. In G is a new Fibonacci, and we just loop from 1 to 10 and print the next G, or the next value that is yielded by that function. That's just one example. There are many other extensions to the language in JavaScript 1.7, but you can't really use that in actual programming. Next, patterns and techniques. Singleton is a pretty popular pattern. However, in JavaScript, that's pretty much just a regular object because you don't have classes. You can just create one object that is there that can't be instantiated and so on, and that has its own state. That's pretty much a no-brainer in JavaScript. Inheritance is a bit more complicated in JavaScript because it has this prototypal object orientation. It's still easy nonetheless. We just create a new object with a value and a function that prints the value of this object. Then we create another function that acts as the constructor, and the prototype of that function is a new object foo. So we basically link the prototype from the bast function to the foo function or to the foo object. And then we can manipulate the prototype of bass, which just changed the value. So the function from the ancestor prints the new value. And when we execute a new foo.bar, it prints foo because foo's value is foo. And if we do the same with the new bass, it prints bass because the value from the inherited or from the derived object is bass. Continues. We can also create a better bar function that adds another string in front of that, and it can still access the this value like that. That prints value.bass. Okay. Next up, the decorator. Decorators are pretty useful because oftentimes you find yourself wanting to create a new class that is only slightly different from another function or from another class. But in JavaScript, you don't really have to create a new full-blown derived object because you can just override methods from an instantiated class or from an instantiated object. To do that, we can extend the function prototype. The function prototypes are basically the function objects. So each function gets a new method named decorate here. We have two parameters, pre and post. And first, we save this value so that we can access this value of the outer function in the inner, the return function. In the return function, we execute the pre-function that is passed as the first parameter with the same this should actually be old, not this. Or wait. That's correct. Okay, then we execute the original function. old is the original function. And then we execute the post function, and that way we can add a function in front of that function and at a function after that function. Our use is just create a new object with a prototype, create a new instance of that object, and now we can decorate that function, that bastard bar function, by just passing a new pre function into that. And so whenever bast.bar is executed, first this function is executed, then the original function, and then the post function would be executed, which is not present here. So when you execute bast.bar message, it first prints pre and then prints message, because it first executes that function, then this function with a parameter message, and prints that message. Delegates. In just a pretty good pattern is to delegate tasks to another object to not make one object too complex. You can use many different delegate objects. So if you have one task that can be done in many different ways, you can just pass a an object to another object or to another function, and that function or object uses that function to do its to do certain tasks. For example, let's for example take a slideshow. A slideshow has to load pictures or has to load data for displaying those pictures. When you have like 10 pictures or 20 pictures, that's not a big deal. You can just insert it into the page header, for example, and load it. But it turns out that there are users who create slideshows with 600 pictures. And if you load 600 pictures or the data for those pictures into the header, that's going to be a pretty large page, and that's not what you want. So you can create a simple data source for like small small amounts of data, and that simple data source has just two functions, length, which returns the overall length or the amount of items that is available, and item, which returns a particular item. But you can also create a more complex data source object, which does calls to the server side. Create a new prototype for that function. The length loads the data from the server. This is just code I made up. You might want to use the Ajax functionality provided by the JavaScript library you use, or use your own. And the item fetches the new data from the server. The way this is used, we created a new slideshow object. For example, this is named object here, just which takes a data source object, and it just loops over those items and does something with these items. For example, display these items. You've got two ways to to create an object. First, a simple data source, which is just that object, or you can create a new data source. Or you can create a new data source object with that URL, and so that the slideshow object uses that data source to retrieve its objects instead of just hard coding the source of those objects directly into the slideshow object. You can basically work with two different models. With delegates, the pull versus the push model. Pull is pretty simple. You have an object and a delegate, and the object just calls the delegate and uses the return value. This is called a synchronous call. And you can do an asynchronous call. So the object basically just sends a message to the delegate to do something. And when the delegate is finished, it calls another method from the original object that treats the return value or does something with the return value. This is typically done by supplying just a method that does something when the delegate is finished with its action. For example, when loading data, it is usually better to use an asynchronous call because synchronous calls totally block the client and the user can't do anything on the page, can't even scroll. And especially if the network connection is flaky, you might have to wait several seconds, and that's just not acceptable. This is also why HCheck is called HCheck, because the first A is asynchronous. A pretty popular pattern are named parameters. Now, JavaScript doesn't really have a specific syntax for naming parameters like Ruby does, but you can just create something yourself by which is create that extend functions, which takes an object and variables it should copy into that object. We just loop over those new variables and insert it into the object like that. So if the property is already available, we insert the children into the children of that object. If it's not available, we just insert it right away. The way this can be used is create a new function which just takes one parameter instead of like five different parameters in a certain order. It just creates one and extends this, so the new object with the parameters. This looks like that. You just create a new object on the fly with position left and start three. And if you have many different parameters for a constructor, this is usually the better way to do it because you don't have to remember the order of the parameter or pass null values to omit certain parameters and so on. Currying. Does someone know what currying is? No, okay. Currying was invented in 1967 by Haskell Curry, the inventor of the Haskell programming language. And currying is also used in languages like Ruby, Haskell, and Smalltalk. Currying is basically a way to pre-configure function parameters and pre-configure the context a function is run in. So you can create derivative functions of another function. You can also, alter the context when the function is called, like I said. Let's look at the code. We'll create a new function prototype, function named curry. So each function gets yet another method named curry. So we can basically curry each function now. It takes a single parameter, just to define some variables here. This code is pretty complex, and if you're interested in it, I suggest looking at the code when you have some time, because it's not that easy to understand. Unfortunately, JavaScript has, in a function you have the arguments variable available, which just contains an array of all arguments passed to that functions. However, arguments is not a real array. It looks like an array, but it's not a real array, and you can't use all array functions. So you have to, we just have to create a real array from that argument object by just using that for loop. And from that function, we return a new function which adds the old parameters. And I really suggest that you look at that function because it's pretty cryptic and it's pretty difficult to understand from just looking at the code. The best way to really understand that is to experiment in a browser or in a JavaScript console. What we do here is basically just concatenate the parameters from both function calls. We have two functions calls that we have an example later, and execute that function by the apply method of that function with the parameters, with the concatenated parameters from the outer function call, from the first function call, and the actual function call here. And let's look at what you can do with that. We just have an add function, which basically just adds two variables together, which is parse them in case they are strings or whatever. We oftentimes have, or we oftentimes want to add 5 to a particular number, so we can create a new function, add 5. The first parameter is the context, and we don't need the context here, so we just pass null. And we create that add function and pass null pass 5 as the second parameter. The second parameter here will be the first parameter here when the add 5 function is executed. So we can basically pre-fill the parameters, and the add 5 function now has only just one parameter that is used, b, and we can just call add 5 10. And it adds 10 to 5 because we pre-configured the parameter or the first parameter to 5. This is especially necessary or useful when you deal with events in the browser, because when an event is executed or when an event function is executed, it modifies this variable. And by just passing a custom this as the first parameter, you can basically fix this parameter from the called function to a certain value or to your object. For example, like that. We have a foo function, does something. And when the user clicks on that A link, this is jQuery syntax, by the way, but you can do that with pretty much every other JavaScript library. We query that foo function with the scope, with this as the string test here. So in that function, this will be test. Usually, if you have done event programming in JavaScript before, this will be something else depending on what the user clicked on, and it's pretty difficult to retrieve the actual object the user dealt with. So that's a pretty good way to change the context the function is executed in. Next up is memoization. This is a pretty useful pattern to save intermediate results when you have when you want to calculate things. For example, we take our Fibonacci function again. The problem with the previous Fibonacci function was that it calculated most values twice or even more times because it didn't save intermediate results. And when it needed n minus 1 and n minus 2, it just calculated them anew. But we can pretty easily just store these values. Okay, so this function, this is a function that is executed right away, and memo will be the array 0 and 1. These are the base values of the predefined values of the Fibonacci function. In that function, we return the function, so the inner function is actually stored in the Fibonacci variable out there. So the Fibonacci function takes an n, number you want to calculate, the Fibonacci value off. And now we look whether we have the value or the result for n already stored in memo. And if that's not the case, like in this branch, we calculate it and store it in memo n. So memo n is basically now filled with the result, and we just return the memo n. Now, this is the advantage that when you execute the function, it just calculates each value once, and stores it into memo, and when the function is called again, yeah?
I don't get it where the n has come from.
The n is the parameter for that function, and this function is stored in this variable.
Yeah, but
so,
the variable, we have a function, an anonymous function with the argument called memo in FIB. I give return, and this, how does it call? Is it called a function? Or
say it again.
No, it's a function definition. It's not a, you call it fib with n.
Yeah, which is called fib with, say, 24, and that inner function is evaluated, but the inner function has still access to the memo, and this is done to not pollute the global namespace so that we have lots of different values which just hide the value from the global namespace, but the inner Fibonacci function that's returned and stored into the outer function or into the outer variable name still has access to that because of the scope. Okay, we can just now execute the Fibonacci function for, say, 24. And when we execute Fibonacci for 8, we don't have to do any calculations at all because this will be false, this expression. And so we just return memo n because we already calculated it in the previous function call, and we still have stored it in the previous function.
So that's faking a static variable.
Basically, yeah.
Speak up. Louder. Question we did snippet, called snippet.
Hmm?
Why is memo passed in into the out function that defined it?
We could do that as well. That was just done to save space. That's all. We could just have defined that in the outer function. Yeah, okay. This is the code. Look at the fib function, we now just have the inner function, which has still access to the outer memo variable. Yeah. When we execute that, too much trick. I actually tried that with much larger values and I didn't get that error. Sorry? I'm sorry. Huh. Yeah, okay. It usually works, or we can just increase the stack so that we can have much deeper recursion. Okay, that's just an example anyway, so.
Sorry, what's that interpreter you got there? Is that CMonkey or?
Yeah, that's there are different JavaScript consoles. There's one from the Mozilla, there are actually two from the Mozilla project. There's Reno, which is rather old, and there's CMonkey. From the Mozilla project, you can just download that from the Mozilla webpage. If you search for CMonkey, you'll find it. And there's one from WebKit. When you just download WebKit nightly, it has a binary called JSC, which also has a JavaScript console. Unfortunately, it doesn't support some thing, so CMonkey is probably the most convenient console. Or you can just...
It's a browser.
I mean SpiderMonkey, sorry, yeah. SpiderMonkey is the JavaScript engine from Mozilla.
Okay.
or from the current Mozilla builds. Okay. Okay. Let's look at how we can debug and analyze JavaScript code. First, there's Firebug. I think most people know Firebug. If you don't, you really have to check it out because it contains a JavaScript console that is really useful and has lots of features. You can just log things or print things instead of alerting all the time when you debug. You also have a DOM inspector. And it has a JavaScript debugger, and you can just step through your JavaScript code, hover over variable names, and see what the values of these are, set breakpoints, and so on. And it's pretty convenient to use, and definitely a better way to shotgun debugging with alerts and so on. It also allows you to profile JavaScript activity, so you can just click on profile, do some things on the page, you click on stop profiling, and it tells you what functions have been executed, how long they have taken, and so on. And so that's, if your JavaScript application is pretty slow, that's probably a good way to find bottlenecks, because you can see how long each function call takes, and so on. You can get that at getfirebug.com. Firebug Lite is a JavaScript console for other browsers. Unfortunately, it doesn't have profiling, and it doesn't really have all the advanced features Firebug has, but it's getting better. I think they added something like a DOM inspector in the recent versions, but it still doesn't do your laundry. You can obtain that at getfirebug.com/lite.html. If you want to debug JavaScript in Internet Explorer, there's a free software tool called Visual Web Developer 2008 Express Edition. So the actual name is Microsoft Visual Web Developer 2008 Express Edition. It's free. Free means that you don't have to pay for it. It's not really free software. You basically get a JavaScript debugger for Internet Explorer, and you can just step through the code like in Firebug. It's free. But you have to mess with it a bit to get it to work, because it the JavaScript debugger is to debug ASP.NET JavaScript. You just have to load or you just have to execute a blank page in Visual Web Developer 2008 Express Edition, and then load your custom URL into the started Internet Explorer, and then you have the debugging session with this piece of software. You can download that at this URL, or you can just type that into search engine, and you'll probably find it. WebDevHelper is also an extension for Internet Explorer. It also provides a JavaScript console, which is useful. It logs HTTP calls. For example, if you have a AJAX-heavy application, you can inspect all the HTTP calls to the server. It also includes a JavaScript backtracer, so if something fails, you can see what functions have been called before and what the stack trace is and so on. You can download that at this URL. And the last tool is JavaScript Lint. A lint is a tool for analyzing code. Basically, there are lints for other languages as well. JavaScript Lint discovers sloppy coding, so JavaScript is a pretty generous word when it comes to codings. For example, you can just leave off semicolons if you have a line break after that command. However, I wouldn't really recommend that, because you run into all kinds of problems when you leave off the semicolons. You can run JavaScript Lint as a command line application, and that allows you to use JavaScript lint, for example, as a pre-commit hook for a revision control system that forbids checking in JavaScript files which contain errors or which have missing semicolons and so on. And that's probably a good way to ensure that your JavaScript style is good. JavaScript lint can be downloaded here. There's also a TextMate bundle for TextMate users that just performs a JavaScript lint on every whenever you save the file, and it displays to you whether you have warnings and errors and so on. Okay. These are some of the sources I have used. There are a lot more sources for these information, but I couldn't remember all of them. Okay, so that's pretty much that pretty much concludes it. Questions? Yeah.
How do you rate the maintainability of JavaScript code? Because all the fancy stuff is pretty hard to understand when you're an external developer or when you come into a team, or even if you've written it a month ago and you see it and say, oh, what's going on?
Like in every project, maintainability depends very heavily on documentation. So if you describe what the code does in your own language, you probably have a much easier time understanding that code. If you don't comment your JavaScript code at all, it's probably difficult to understand. But that's pretty much true for every code if it's not simple stuff.
Yeah, and there's this other thing that, I mean, a lot of patterns in JavaScript look like really bad hacks or like tricks and stuff, but this is commonly misunderstood, because it's not like somebody's trying to hack a problem. Just using the concepts of the language, like, for instance, closures and stuff like that, to achieve the certain functionality, it's not a hack. And once you got to understand these concepts of JavaScript, well, then it's much more readable and more understandable than it looks at the first sight.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
You showed a specific example of memorization.
Yeah.
Whereas with curry, you showed a general recipe. How would you turn memorization into a general recipe to minimize any function?
You can actually generalize memorization. For example, in this book, it is shown how to generalize that. You just create a function prototype method that allows you to add memorization to any function. So it basically checks if the function has already been called with that parameter, and if that's the case, it just returns the value because it has saved this return value. And that's definitely possible.
Generalize is just as easy as a shortcut
curry. Curring is actually something slightly different. So curring is not about remembering the return value.
Said it generalizes just
as Yeah. Not really.
I can tell something about
that.
I looked at several browsers, and the main problem I observed all browsers, but Firefox, was that memory was not actually freed after nor the execution of the script, nor the closing of the tab, and sometimes not even closing the window would free that memory. So Firefox 3 was the first browser where we actually observed a reduction of memory footprint once the script was done, and where it freed memory explicitly inside the script. But it's, memory leaks are quite a big deal. Especially when dealing with some objects, stuff like that. You get the certain references and several environments where you might get to a reference to a DOM object.
Hmm.
And the DOM object float pretty much in the, in the memory.
Yeah, but that's pretty much a browser or an implementation issue and not really an issue of the language.
Is there really no way of printing out a value except alert unless you use Firebug or something?
Where would you print that to?
The console. There is a JavaScript in the browser where you can see all the errors, but without generating an error, just putting a value there.
I'm not aware of a way in Mozilla. Safari has a console method or console.log method that allows you to log to the console. That's built in. It's possible that there is something for Firefox as well.
This standard function is called dump. You just have to enable that and output it to the command line and make it from.
Okay, yeah.
Just dump and whatever value or string.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
Can you have a word on the eval function regarding, let's say, memory consumption or error tracking, like when you eval large parts of scripts? What's your experience?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
The JavaScript eval function.
Yeah.
It's nowadays widely used. Like in our project, we use it to load scripts dynamically from the server and we eval the script. So, but we, in before loading, we cannot determine how large the script will be. So we, is there any boundaries, any restrictions?
I don't know. However, there's a way to execute or to load scripts without using eval. I think jQuery has something like that, and possibly other libraries have something like that as well, which doesn't use eval, because like in every language, eval might be necessary or convenient sometimes, but actually you don't need that. But I can't really say anything about the memory consumption, sorry. Okay, yeah.
If you're just listing available debuggers, I think you could add that the developer builds of Safari also have increasingly powerful debuggers.
Yeah, they also have a JavaScript console, which also allows you to look at the JavaScript code. I'm not sure whether Drosera is already included into the Safari or WebKit. I think it's still a standalone app for debugging Safari or JavaScript.
I have a download from the developer side. It's integrated. It's
okay.
Maybe web developer or so. And SourceLink debugger, pretty nice. It's
okay.
Still evolving, but
Have to look at that yet, but yeah. Okay, thanks.
Can you give us an overview of the available JavaScript libraries and why would I use it?
I don't think that I'm the right person to do that, because I pretty much exclusively use jQuery as JavaScript library. There are other JavaScript libraries like Dojo, YUI, a prototype, XJS, and so on. But it really depends on what you already know and what you want to do. And I don't think there's a general recommendation which fits every use case. So there's no definite answer I can give you. Sorry. Okay. Thanks for attending.